All right. Can I ask you to do me a favor? I see a few head nods. All right, good. Those are nine words that can give us pause when we hear them, aren't they? Especially like when someone from the right, hey, can I ask you to do me a favor? Yeah, you can see just a little bit of, oh, what's he going to ask? You know, but for instance, if I said, how many, raise your hand this morning if you had more than 25 trick-or-treaters come by your house on Thursday. See, I didn't even necessarily, I said, what if I asked you? And you just were like ready to do me a favor and raise your hands anyway. But that's an easy one. In fact, I bet if this podium tipped over right now, if I looked down and said, Monty, could you pick that up for me?
Absolutely.
Yeah, Monty would be in a heartbeat, Monty. But I wonder if I asked, like, Maggie, would you come up and just go ahead and preach the rest of the sermon for me? I've got a great set of notes here. You can just kind of read right through it. I give you my headset. She's like, all of a sudden her pupils just, we got one over there. Yeah, I thought about that. I was like, I got to be careful who I ask, because somebody might say yes. No, okay. Now, going back to Monty, though, if he watched me tip this stand over on purpose, and then I asked him to pick it up for me, would you be, you'd probably still do it, right? You would probably do it. What if I did it again? What if I did it again? If I knocked it over twice, I'm on my own after the second. I was wondering how far that would have to go. Favors usually, we draw boundaries around where we're willing to do favors. I think about that because I was thinking about that example, and I thought, when our kids were small and they would have food on their high chair tray and they would pick up their sippy cup and throw it at the ground, and you bend over and you pick it up and you don't do that again. And I think about, I don't even know what the count was. Josh, do you remember how many times it was? Josh, he was always trying to push that envelope. He's like, can I get him into the teens this time before he just takes it away and deprives me of, of any nourishment? Boundaries on favors have several different variables that help us decide whether or not we're going to do a favor. It's, how well we know and love the person. So that's why I knew, Monty, I could count on you to pick it up at least once for me here. The perceived reason why they can't do it themselves. Like, at some certain point, Monty would be like, why isn't he bending over and picking this up himself? If I was carrying a bunch of other stuff, if I had my hands tied behind my back or something like that, more willing than if it's just, I really don't want to bend over. It's a lot of work. That might be less of a good reason. The level of difficulty or inconvenience for us, our perception of whether or not they deserve that favor. Would they do that for someone else? Because if we think they would do it for us or for someone else, then we're probably more likely to do it for them. And it's how all those elements blend together that ultimately decides, it's going to be this weird math equation we do in our head when, most of the time when someone says, would you do me a favor, we probably go, well, you can ask. That's, what is the favor you need done? We want more information. Very rarely, and for very few people, would we say an unconditional yes, absolutely, I'm going to do you a favor. Maggie, what would the parameters be? Like, what would you need to happen in order to come up and, preach? Like, that's a big ask. She's like, there are no parameters. I was going to say, because I bet for some of you, maybe, I bet Sophie, I bet if I gave you enough time, do you think, and time to prepare and plan? You would do it? All right, Sophie's going to come on up here and finish. There's a certain set of parameters that are going to help us get there, and it's going to be different for different people. Favor is an idea that arises in both of the two stories. Remember, we're telling two stories that happen in the same town, starting with the story of Ruth, and then we're going to get into that other story that because it's not December yet, we can't talk about Christmas, except that we've already put up our Christmas lights at home. Anybody else? Anybody else got a tree up? First place, two trees. We have two trees up, lit.
It's not Thanksgiving.
It's after Halloween, so do you have a Thanksgiving tree? I mean, come on. Why not? Specifically, favor rises as a word that's used in reference to both of the two heroines in the story. Ruth, in the story we're going through now, and Mary, when we get into the Christmas story. We hear this word, favor. For today, we have the opportunity to see what kind of person is more likely to receive favor from the people around us. We can't make people do favors for us. We can't make people show us favor. We can't force kindness, but we can aim to be the kind of people who others find it easy to favor. And favor is pretty nice, isn't it? It can help us get jobs. It can build. It can be a thing that opens up introductions to new friends. It certainly helps to have those who would do favors for you when you have a big task to do. And I think about over the summer when I built my pond, I could not have put the liner in by myself. I had Jeff, Eric, and Jacob. I'm missing somebody. Jeff, Eric, and Jacob? Yeah, okay. I had Jeff, Eric, and Jacob to help me move this gigantic piece, you know, 25-foot square, you know, rubber thing that was hot in the sun and kind of miserable. That was why we made Jacob be the one who actually got down in the middle to president, because he could take it. They were willing to do me a favor and come help out. And, you know, the benefits to life are clearly there, to have people who have are willing to show us favor. But there's also benefit to the mission of Jesus when the church operates this way. From the very beginning of the church's story in Acts 2:47, we read this after this description of what the church was doing. It says, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people, every day the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. As a part of this big description, one of the things that was happening is the people in Jerusalem are watching this newborn church, and they were showing them favor because what they were watching was something good, something that somehow engaged them and made them want to show favor. This is the ending of that description of what they were doing, and great fruitfulness happened in the context of great favor. So I want to reset the stage a little bit for the story we're in right now. Naomi's family moved from Bethlehem to the foreign land of Moab during a famine. While there, her boys married outside of the faith. Then her husband died. Then her sons died. Naomi was left with two Moabite daughters-in-law who were both willing to come back to Bethlehem with her. She tries to chase them off, and one returns to life in Moab. The other, Ruth, the namesake of the book we're studying, our focal point for today, clings to her mother-in-law, embracing not only her, but her people, her land, her God. She says, this is who I am now. When they arrive in Bethlehem, they cause quite a commotion. Naomi's back, but not with the men that they saw her leave with, but with this one stranger. Naomi, whose name means pleasant, tells the crowd that she's not using that name anymore, that from now on they should call her Mara, which means bitter. She's bitter at life. She's bitter at God. She's bitter at everything in between for the losses she has faced. We talked about that a lot last week. I mentioned that the word Mara came out of a story in Exodus, where the people grew angry with Moses and God because they found a spring. They were thirsty. They found a spring, but the water was bitter. And so they called the spring Mara. But when God heard the cry, he showed Moses a branch. And when the branch was thrown into the bitter, what was death became a source of life. And I'm going to reference that a little bit each time here because it's an image I want you to hold on because it's going to keep coming back in this story and in the story to come, this idea of the branch being thrown into the bitterness and becoming a source of life. And Ruth 1 closes with the line that literally could be read, they just so happened. It was just this coincidence that they arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And I noted that Ruth has no references to God taking direct action in the story. There's just several winks and nods, things just so happening in ways that clearly are more than coincidence. Well, so with that backdrop, let's continue on in the story in Ruth 2. So Ruth 2, 1 through 3 is where we're going to pick up here. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side. He was a prominent man of noble character from Elimelech's family. His name was Boaz. Ruth the Moabitess asked Naomi, "Will you let me go into the fields and gather fallen grain behind someone with whom I find favor?" Naomi answered her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So Ruth left and entered the field to gather grain behind the harvesters. She happened to be in the portion of the field belonging to Boaz, who was from Elimelech's family. So quick pause there. Did you catch it? The English misses the nuance, but if you're looking for it, and I kind of emphasized it there pretty heavily, she happened to be in the field, in the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. Just so happened. You know, I don't know if you remember last week, we commented on in Jewish literature, you know, one of these exciting things I love to bring up, that it was the normal routine, because names were so important in Jewish culture, that they would mention the name first and then talk about what they did. And you were meant to, if you were one of the original hearers, you would have known, I take what I understand about the name and now I interpret the actions through the lens of that name. And so in Elimelech's case, it was reversed. There's this weird dynamic where the writer reverses it and goes into all the details about what Elimelech did before talking about his name. So that way you would read the name through the lens of the event. So that way you would read, oh, this guy was, his name means God is king, but the reality is he's putting himself in charge. And there was this problem. This writer breaks that. But here's the flip of that. What do we get here? We get at the very start, we get Naomi had a relative, and we get some accolades. We get some information about him, but we don't get any events. His name was Boaz, right? We get the name right out in front. There's this guy of noble character. He's of Elimelech's family, and his name is Boaz. And it's interesting. Verse 1 mentions he's a relative, but then did you catch the way this ends? Like, it starts off by saying there was a man who was a relative of Naomi, and then it ends by, oh, Boaz, who was from Elimelech's family. Like, we get this double connection. That's not on accident. The Bible doesn't do things like that on accident. Where there's repetition like that, saying this is an important hint of what God is trying to do in this story. So, moving on. Hold that thought. Verses 4 through 7. Later, when Boaz arrived from Bethlehem, he said to the harvesters, "The Lord be with you." "The Lord bless you," they replied. Boaz asked his servant, who was in charge of the harvesters, "Whose young woman is this?" The servant answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the territory of Moab. She asked, 'Will you let me gather fallen grain among the bundles behind the harvesters?' She came and has been on her feet since early morning, except that she rested a little in the shelter." So right here, we see the first element in Ruth's character that makes her to be a person for whom people want to show favor. And that is Ruth's diligence and hard work. Diligence and hard work. Proverbs 13:4 reads this way. It says, "The slacker craves, yet has nothing, but the diligent is fully satisfied." I want to be clear on a matter here, just a detail of this sermon. This is not a sermon about who we should show favor to. Okay, though I will get there a little bit here. Jesus has much to say about who we should show favor to. And even just skimming through the Sermon on the Mount will show us that favor should be shown to all. In fact, especially those who don't deserve it and those who would be outside of the boundaries of whom we think we should show favor to. But we're talking about becoming people who are more likely to receive favor. And Ruth demonstrates the wisdom of Proverbs, which, for the record, hadn't been written yet. Though, as this story plays out into the future, she actually does kind of have that's later. It is easy in life to be frustrated by what we don't have. Maybe even what we feel we deserve, but not recognize our own role in getting it. For example, if I knock the stand over, I can pick it back up. Like, I can take that action on my own. Me being someone who does that makes it more likely to, if I can't, someone being willing to pick it back up. You know, I think I've been blessed with favor in my life with a couple of different jobs. You know, my first job in a bank came through a friend of my dad. But the reason he took a chance on me was that he had heard from my dad that I worked hard and earned some business awards when I was in high school. And that made him go, oh, that's probably someone who would be worth investing in. You know, Ruth asked Naomi to allow her to go work in the fields rather than just sitting and complaining about the hunger. You know, the law in Israel going all the way back to Leviticus, is that when you were harvesting your field, if you had a field, you were not to harvest the corners of the field. You were to leave those alone. And in fact, if you dropped anything as you were harvesting, you had to leave it on the ground. And the reason for that is so that way people like Ruth could glean. They could come along behind the actual employees, the members of the household. So in this case, Boaz's field, the members of the household are doing this work. Ruth could come along behind and pick up the scraps behind and not go hungry. It was something built in to create opportunity. It's specifically for the widow, the orphan, and the alien, which Ruth fits all three categories, doesn't she? So she isn't going and getting a job working in Boaz's field. His household has that covered. She's going to gather behind them. That's hard, inefficient work, right? You think about how much easier it is when an apple tree is full of apples, how much easier it is to pick apples than when there's only a few left on the high branches that you're trying to reach for, and they're probably not the ones that are the best anymore. Probably the best ones have been picked. Well, I imagine the same thing. I'm not a barley harvester. I don't have that background, but I imagine the same is true. It's hard, inefficient work, and we're talking about the heat of the Middle East here. Boaz notices this, and so he asks, okay, what's her story? Let's look at what the servant noticed and reported. We just read this one. We'll go one more time here. The servant answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who returned with Naomi from the territory of Moab. She asked, 'Will you let me gather fallen grain among the bundles behind the harvesters?' She came and has been on her feet since early morning, except that she rested a little in the shelter." He hears a couple traits about this Ruth. She's steadfast in her relationships, and she works hard. She showed up early. She kept going, except she did take a little bit of rest. Diligence and hard work. Very tangible qualities, but what about the intangible qualities that we see? Ruth 2, 8 through 10. Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, don't go and gather grain in another field, and don't leave this one, but stay here close to my female servants. See which field they are harvesting and follow them. Haven't I ordered the young men not to touch you? When you are thirsty, go and drink from the jars the young men have filled." She fell face down, bowed to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor with you so that you notice me, although I am a foreigner?" I think this is another one of the traits we see in the way she responds to Boaz's favor that is one of those things that makes it more likely for us to receive favor, and that's humility and gratitude. She demonstrated humility and gratitude. If Ruth exemplifies the proverb about hard work, she shines in regard to a trait that James tells us that God takes special note of. James 4, 6 says, "God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble." If God enjoys showing extra favor to the humble, how much more simply for us? You know, we've reached a point in the story where Ruth is beginning to receive significant favor, specifically from Boaz. He gives her instruction to stay in his field, to follow his servants. He's given orders for protection to guard her. And remember, we talked about this last week, how vulnerable Ruth was, how vulnerable Naomi was in the situation. And so, you know, Boaz goes, "Hey, I'm going to put just this extra protection. Like, no one is going to harm you because I've given them clear instructions not to harass you, not to bother you, to take care of you." He even told his workers to share their water with her. Here's the intangible. She doesn't feel entitled to any of it. She didn't demand anything. She doesn't expect it. She says, "Why have I found favor with you?" She demonstrates gratitude and she demonstrates humility. You know, back to me tipping over the music stand here. You know, Monty and I agreed that he'd be happy to pick it up for me, maybe even more than once. How fast would that go away if when it fell down, I said, "Are you going to pick that up or what?" I felt weird even saying that to Monty. I don't like it. You know, church, this is so important. Whenever I coach young couples who are getting ready to get married, I talk at length. It's the number one thing. In fact, I almost tie everything else back to this idea of expectations. What are we expecting from our partner? And it doesn't just apply in marriages, but in every other relationship, job, school, situation, wherever our expectations are, whatever we feel entitled to is going to be the relationship killer. Humility is the opposite of that. It doesn't assume you are owed something, and so it's graceful and grateful when you receive. You know, especially now that we're a house of all adults, all grown-ups, no one is expected to do the dishes in our house. Like, no one, we haven't assigned that chore to anyone. And so we all practice extra gratitude when someone steps up and does it. Because in those moments where we all forget, it can get a little chaotic. So when Josh or Monica or sometimes even me remembers, hey, you know what? I want to make sure there's coffee cups in the morning. That's usually what triggers it for me, is when I realize my coffee cups aren't clean. We do expect one another to rinse the cheese out of bowls, though. Like, if you got melted cheese, like, best be getting that out. Like, right? Like, that's where the trouble comes. That's where we might get on each other's nerves a little bit. But you see, that's where the expectation lies is where the relationship can be impacted. When at work, what do you expect versus what do you earn? You know, there's a phrase that gets thrown out a lot now called quiet quitting. I don't know if you're familiar with this term. It's the idea that if your employer doesn't meet your expectations, you do the minimum work possible to not get fired, or maybe even a little bit less. It's you just unplug, disconnect, you scale your work back, maybe even until you're not meeting their expectations. They give you the bare minimum, you give them the bare minimum. There's logic to it, and it might even be fairness in that, but it shouldn't be a surprise that new opportunities don't often come along. I hear some of the same voices that say, well, yeah, I'm quiet quitting, I'm not going to, whether or not they use that term. They talk about, yeah, I'm not putting any extra work there, but then they're like, why doesn't anybody else want to hire me? There's something that happens there. But I'd say even more than the lack of favor that comes when we have that attitude of entitlement, it's just a miserable way to live. Humility and gratitude are actually higher indicators of life satisfaction than income or even satisfying work. Someone who chooses to just humbly get in and do the work and be grateful for what they have can be more happy in a coal mine than an attorney who's grumbling while making six digits, right? When we start with humility and gratitude, it's amazing how often greater opportunities seem to come along. You know, after losing one job in my early days, I ended up doing seasonal work at Target. I think I've talked about this before. Some of you may remember me talking about that. Until one of my old coworkers from the job I'd had before saw me there while she was shopping with her husband, and she told him about the kind of coworker that I had been when I worked with her at the bank. And it just so happened that he was an employer who had a position open at a job that was a whole lot more fun than working seasonal work at Target. I did not like the job that I lost, and I frankly really didn't like the job at Target. And I didn't always have a great attitude about it, but there was apparently enough. There was enough that I showed that Diane stuck her neck out for me, and that fed my family for the next couple of years. Diligence and hard work, humility and gratitude, but there was one other thing that Boaz really took notice of here, verse 11 and 12. Boaz answered her, "Everything you have done for your mother-in-law since your husband's death has been fully reported to me. How you left your father and mother and your native land, how you came to a people you didn't previously know. May the Lord reward you for what you have done, and may you receive a full reward from the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." Ruth's kindness and loyalty played a huge role in the favor that she would receive. Boaz, if we didn't mention this already, was a relative of Elimelech. So I'm sure he knew Naomi. He knew the family well before they left, and when things went wrong, when the cost was high, Ruth had the option, and in fact was even encouraged, to take care of number one. Ruth was encouraged, go take care of yourself. But as we read last week, Ruth clung to Naomi. She would not allow her to walk that road alone. She showed kindness and loyalty. To her own cost, and giving up any real hope of a future, she went as an alien orphan and widow to the land of Israel. When you read commentaries on the book of Ruth, Much is made of Boaz being a type or an example of Jesus. We're going to talk about him a lot next week because there is some amazing stuff there, and that's absolutely true. But don't look past Ruth as an example of Jesus. She laid down her life for Naomi. She denied herself and took up her cross for Naomi. How could Boaz observe the way that Ruth was living her life and not respond with favor? How could he look at the way she was living her life and not respond? You know, that kind of living even transforms enemies into friends. You know, there's an old story told about Abraham Lincoln. After a very heated election, he's the guy who appointed some of his biggest political enemies into his cabinet. After the Civil War, there was a woman who was criticizing him harshly because he didn't obliterate the South. She thought, how can you forgive them? How can you work on this reconciliation and bringing them back in? Like, all the senators from the South should be hung. We should just, you know, like, the South should just be cut off and we should just take it over. Like, anybody who ever was there should go. And his response to her demand that he obliterate his enemies, he says, "Madam, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends?" It's the kind of guy that he was. Good notes for how maybe we can change the tenor of the conversation around politics today even. The rest of the chapter shows Ruth continue in a posture of hard work, humility, and loyal kindness. We see those things keep coming up. She expresses gratitude for his generous favor. He invites her to join him for a meal, during which she gets a to-go box for Naomi. After the meal, Boaz gives his workers directions, not only to let her be without harassment, but even says, hey, as you're going, drop a few extra bundles. Like, drop it in heaps here. Don't just, like, accidentally drop a piece here and there. Like, every now and then just grab a handful and toss it out behind you. Make her path easier. Instead of picking up a little here, a little there, as it happened to fall, she's got piles now to pick up. At the end of the day, she processed what she harvested, and the net gain she took home, according to what the translators kind of calculated out to, was about 26 quarts. So that's about 7 1-gallon milk jugs filled with barley. Naomi is flabbergasted when she sees what Ruth brings home. She goes, "Where were you working?" Ruth tells her about Boaz, and here we get a big hint about where the story is going to go. Ruth 2:20. Then Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May the Lord bless him because he has not abandoned his kindness to the living or the dead." Naomi continued, "This man is a close relative. He is one of our family redeemers." Every one of the original listeners to this story, this would have been the moment they went, aha, there it is. That's what we were looking for. Here's where the story really turns the corner. You see, even before the law of Moses made it official for Israel, there was a custom in the ancient Middle East that is weird to us, but it made perfect sense in that culture. You know, as we established last week, there was no one more vulnerable than a widow with no sons. They had no, in a patriarchal culture, there was no one to support them, no one to protect them, no one to defend them, no one to make sure they got what they needed, no power in that space. It was also considered a devastating blow to the family tree to have one of the branches cut off. Like, it was a lack of honor, especially because property would, you know, pass down inheritance and the name of someone, even if they weren't a great person, that their name would continue was so important. They valued those. And so the practice would be that a close relative of the man would take in the widow as his wife, and then the firstborn son would actually carry on the heritage of the dead man. They would take on that their child wouldn't be counted as theirs. It would be counted as their brother's. It would be counted as their close relative's child, who would then inherit the property and the legacy, the inheritance to carry on that family line. This family, Elimelech's family, Boaz's family, was from the tribe of Judah. And if you go back to Genesis, and I don't have time to go here and really unpack this all the way, there is an entire dramatic movement that takes place, kind of breaks up Joseph's story. If you're in Genesis and you're reading about Joseph, all of a sudden there's this weird chapter out of place around the person of Judah, who ends up in this drama because Judah's sons mess up and Judah won't fix it. They try to get out of doing this, and it has all kinds of complications that we're going to come back to in a couple weeks because the story comes full circle on this for the family of Judah in the story of Ruth. Ruth doesn't understand this the way Israel's rules work, but Naomi does. Naomi knows exactly the opportunity that exists here. And I mention this now because it matters not only for what we hear next week, but it actually drives into the very heart of the gospel. It's going to drive into the heart of even the Christmas story. Before I close, and I recap how we can be people who are more likely to be shown favor, I want to highlight this. Naomi and Ruth just happened to come at the beginning of the barley harvest. Ruth just happens to come to Boaz's field. Boaz happens to come by and see Ruth's diligence, hears about her loyal love, and sees her humility. Human favor is showing up in this story, but I hope you see God's favor at work in the story too. God's favor is so strong in the story. Each one of these just so happens. And the question is, what did Naomi do to earn God's favor in the story? She grieved. She blamed him for her coming back empty. She became bitter. She tried to isolate herself. She stayed at home. She did nothing to help herself. She pushed people away from her, acted with pride and self-centeredness. I'm not saying that that's not a natural way for her to act in her situation, but that's what she did. God's favor comes differently than ours does, is what I hope you see here. Because God is showing favor on Naomi. As much as Ruth is the center point of the story, his favor on Naomi is so strong here. After she basically wrote God off, God's favor comes differently. In the New Testament, we'll note that while we were helpless, while we were still his enemies, God sent his son to die for us. When we get to the Christmas story, we're going to hear angels sing to shepherds, "Glory to God in the highest heaven and peace on earth to people he favors." This is why our call to show favor isn't based on what others do, but on what God did. The linchpin of Christian faith is that the God of the universe loves first, seeks first, gives first. The cross proves that. And we were made in his image, made to find our deepest joy and satisfaction in being emptied rather than in being filled. Let me have the worship team come back up. Ruth shows us how to live in a way that attracts favor from others. Hard work and diligence, humility and gratitude, kindness and loyalty. Wherever you are in life, if you desire or need favor from the world around you, take note of those things. Ask, where do I need to take a step in one of these directions? If you're sour, unwilling to do what you can, and expect others to do what you think you need, good luck. Learn to be like Ruth. Learn to be people who others enjoy blessing. Even if they don't choose to bless you, I promise it's still a better way to live with greater joy when we live the way that Ruth did. But also note that at the heart of why Ruth attracted favor is because Ruth gave favor. She was working not only for herself, but for Naomi. She was loyal and kind to one in need. She even favored the ones who blessed her by receiving that blessing with humility and gratitude. See, favor works both directions. So where can you apply this? Where do you need to grow in this area? What's one change you could make in your attitude or in your actions this week that would cause you to live with greater favor for your own benefit, for the needs of others, for the sake of the mission of the gospel? Will you take a moment to consider what maybe that one step might be and then commit yourself to that? And then I'll close in prayer. Father, I recognize in my life, I recognize in the life of this church, there are ways in which we are not like Ruth. Or where we don't do our part, we don't do everything we can, we don't work with diligence. Maybe where we fail to approach with humility, with gratitude, where we don't act like those, maybe we act like those who are entitled to get something rather than those who just desire to give. And where maybe we're just not kind. God, we just ask that you would show us right now what it means to walk like Ruth. Lord, not to earn your favor, God, because we know that you are just aching to give it to us. Lord, your desire is to pour your favor out on your people. Your desire is to pour your favor out on all people. And God, you want to do that through us. You want us to partner with you, but first we need to be those who choose to receive and give favor like you do. So Father, teach us to be like Ruth. Teach us to be examples of sacrifice and humility, hard work and diligence, who love others the way that you first loved us. We offer ourselves to you this morning in Jesus' name. Amen.